10 million people die each year from diseases that have available cures. Nearly one-third of all people on this earth do not have regular access to essential medicines, and in the poorest parts of Africa and Asia, this figure rises to over 50%. Udo Schuklenk, a bioethicist and professor at Queen's University, has written, "In the real world, there is no such thing as a fixed local standard of care. Rather, the local standard of care in, for example, India, is a standard of care determined by the prices set by Western pharmaceutical multinationals. Indeed, the reasons for lack of access to essential medicines are complex, but much of it boils down to price." On today's episode of the Health Justice Radio Collective, we speak with Rachel Kidell Monroe, president of Universities Allied for Essential Medicines, about bridging the access gap.
You're listening to Health Justice Radio Collective on CFMU 93.3.
You're listening to the Health Justice Radio Collective. My name is Nikki Bosnoff, and on the board is Eric Brown. Here with us on the phone is Rachel Kidell Monroe. She has worked in the humanitarian field for over 20 years, and in 2003, Rachel was asked to lead MSS Access to Medicines campaign. She became well known and respected for her groundbreaking work on Canadian initiative to allow the export of generic versions of brand name drugs to developing countries. And since 2007, she has worked with the Universities Allied for Essential Medicines. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, nice to be here.
So, can you tell me a little bit about what Universities Allied for Essential Medicines does and how the organization was founded?
Yeah, the organization was founded in the early 2000s after a campaign that was held at Yale University to try and bring down the price of a building block of an AIDS combination therapy that MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, was wanting to use in South Africa, but the price was so high they were trying to find a way to bring that price down. And students campaigned on that issue, and through their advocacy work with other groups in the Access to Medicines movement, they managed to bring the price right down actually by 96%, which was really key in sort of rolling out AIDS treatment in sub-Saharan Africa. And after that, students in the U.S. became really excited about this idea, as did students in Canada, and the UAM, Universities Allied for Essential Medicines movement was born from that. And we're now present in around 80 research institutions and universities around the world. So not just in Canada and the U.S., but also in Brazil and various developing countries, and a very growing contingent of chapters in Europe.
So what is the scale of the access to medicines problem that we're talking about here?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, as you mentioned in your introduction, there's around 10 million people die each year because they lack access to affordable medicines. And in terms of total access, there's only one in three people are not able to access the medicines that they need, and that number rises to one in two in sub-Saharan Africa. So it's like every other one of us not being able to access, you know, basic medicines that we need for our health.
So there's at least two parts to the access gap, and one of them is access to medicines that are already available, and the other is research and development for drugs that are not yet available. Mm. Can you tell me about what UAM kind of tries to do on these fronts?
Mm. So on the first one, in terms of price, the Universities Allied for Essential Medicines really works from the university campus. So the idea is to try to get universities to change the norms and practices they have around their licensing of medical research, which is happening in their labs. So to put that simply, for instance, if a scientist develops a molecule or a potential treatment, which then the university patents, i.e. it takes out a right to keep ownership of that discovery for the next 20 years, the university will then go out and try to license that discovery to a pharmaceutical company or a biotech company who could then develop it further, and then they take part in the royalties. So if the company is successful in making that into a treatment, the university will receive royalties and the scientist will receive part of those royalties too. So what we're trying to do, make sure, is that within that process, the existing process, that if there is an application of that technology which is based in a university discovery, is found to be useful for people living in developing countries, then there will be an ability to make sure that that license allows free access, i.e. that the university doesn't do anything to hinder that access. And we call that global access licensing. So that's on the first part of it. Then on the second part, in terms of research and development for new applications or improved applications of existing treatments, we're trying to encourage universities to expand their horizons on research and development to include diseases which are affecting the poor mainly, i.e. 90% of the population at the moment who doesn't have access to medicines for diseases which really only they are vulnerable to. So we're talking about things like Chagas disease or sleeping sickness. These kind of diseases, there's very little treatments or very inadequate treatments. And at the moment, universities have not been doing enough research and development in that area.
And is there any indication about why this is? Why aren't neglected diseases, for example, a priority for universities? Who's shaping the research questions, I guess?
Yeah, it's a little bit difficult to say. I mean, in terms of who's shaping the research questions, I think that's the health needs of the populations in the richest countries, so countries like Canada, US, Europe, etc. I think that it's not that universities don't want to do work on neglected diseases, but they haven't yet had much incentive to do it. I think if we're looking from a pharmaceutical corporate perspective, there's clearly very little money in developing drugs for neglected diseases, because we're talking about diseases that poor people suffer from, so the revenues are zero. So that market impact and the market impetus is not there. In universities, they don't have the same goals as a pharmaceutical company, but on the other hand, they are trying to market their discoveries, and therefore they will, and so far have tended to focus more on discoveries which could be of potential corporate interest. And so we're going to have to try, and we're trying to change that paradigm and remind universities of their responsibility for the health and their for their social benefits of university work. And the fact that universities are funded by taxpayers should mean that universities really have to look at the big picture and not focus on one aspect.
And are universities actually big producers of medical technology?
Fairly important, surprisingly important. If you look at the HIV/AIDS treatments that are currently in the market, a large percentage of those came from university labs. And most of the vaccines, no vaccines over the past 25 years have been developed without input from a university in some shape or form. And so universities are very critical in the development, and I think that universities are going to become increasingly important, because as the pharmaceutical industry is changing with the changing globalized world and the changing demands on their drugs, as well as the expiry of the patents on many of their blockbuster medicines, I think universities are going to become more and more important as places of discovery. We already see a trend for pharmaceutical companies to be focusing more on university labs as places where they could get new discoveries which could be of interest for them to develop. And that can be whether through funding labs or having agreements with universities. So there's definitely, universities are definitely coming up more and more.
So a lot of people might argue that patents and high prices are necessary in order to promote innovation in the pharmaceutical industry. So can you maybe debunk that a bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, this is the classic argument. They say that, you know, it costs $1 billion or something to make a drug, and therefore they have to have all this protection in order to guarantee that they get that money back. What has actually been proved by academics in various reports is that despite the presence of patents over the past, well, it's nearly 20 years now since the TRIPS agreement came into place, there hasn't been any increase in the amount of research and development. There was a very important study done which looked at the research and development and innovation from 1995 to 1996 And over that period looked at whether there had been an increase or not, and they'd seen actually a decrease, and that the number of new medicines with an innovative use, i.e. not just reworking of existing molecules, but really new innovative drugs, it was only about 1,300 of them over a 25-year period, and of those, only 13 were of any relevance to developing countries, which is an incredible statistic when you think about the amount of illness and disease that there is in the developing world compared to the types of illness and disease we have here in the developed world. So the proportion is completely out of whack. And that was despite the presence of very strong capability for pharmaceutical companies to protect their drugs through patents.
Mm-hmm. And there's been some initiative to make drugs on a not-for-profit kind of model. Can you tell us anything about that?
Yeah, there are some really interesting initiatives around. I mean, this was a way that people were looking at as an alternative to trying to get pharmaceutical companies to reduce their prices. It's been such an uphill battle, and it's been such a conflicted battle, really pitting, you know, the non-government organizations against the pharmaceutical industry. And the pharmaceutical industry have huge resources and huge capacity, and at some point we have to look for alternative methods. The patent system is here to stay, and there's very little that we can do about that. We try to use the flexibilities that are meant to be built into that patent system, but even that is complex. So one idea was to have this non-profit approach to drugs. So one that I've done some work with and I know more closely is the Drugs for Neglected Disease Initiative. And this was actually grown out of Médecins Sans Frontières after they won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1991. They put all the prize money, which was $1 million, towards setting up this what we call DNDi. And the idea of it was to really focus on the most neglected diseases. So you have, you know, I think it's 13 or something neglected diseases identified by the WHO, the World Health Organization, and DNDi focused on just five of those and said we're going to try and find cures for those by 2000, treatments and cures for those by 2016. So they focused on that, and they work as a basically as a fulcrum for lots of different researchers and scientists all through the world. And a great part of their success is their capacity to involve southern scientists, i.e. scientists working in the global south. And together, a kind of collaboration between different groups comes together to develop cures or treatments. So through that mechanism, they've developed a brand new combination treatment for sleeping sickness. They've developed two new combinations for malaria, which are really very effective. And they're very close to releasing a pediatric version of the key drug that exists for treating Chagas disease in Latin America. So that's one example of how a non-profit drug company has been working.
Mm. And in terms of protecting patents, I mean, it makes sense why they're protected in the developed world. But what incentive do drug companies have to protect them so voraciously in the developing world?
I think it's the issue of principle, really. I think that the idea is that if any, that patents need to be a worldwide system in place. They're very concerned about people obstructing their patents in the developed world, and they seem to feel that any example of letting down the protection of patents will inevitably affect their sort of hold on their discoveries. So in law we talk about opening the floodgates, you know, to cases, and they just don't want to open the floodgates to any challenges to their patents. So the regime is very, very tightly controlled. I think that the TRIPS agreement, so the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Agreement in 1995, was a very, very carefully crafted document, and it leaves very, very little opening for challenge. It was very, Dolores did a good job on it. And the few flexibilities that are available in there are politically not supported, whether it's by the governments of the US or by the European Union. Countries who try to use those flexibilities get a rebuke or get retaliation as a result. So, you know, the patent system has become a very key part of the profits of the pharmaceutical industry, and they don't see any reason why that needs to be affected, because that would mean that their profits would be affected. So the argument is very difficult, because it's from two, you know, it's where you're trying to talk about patients' lives versus profits, and those two conversations don't go together.
Mm-hmm. And in Canada, we do have one of those exceptions or kind of, you know, loopholes. Has there been an update on Canada's access to medicines regime?
Yeah, so Canada tried to take advantage of one of the flexibilities that's included in TRIPS, and did so in 2004, passed a piece of legislation. But in the next 6 years of that legislation's existence, we only managed to get one drug out to 20,000 people in one country. So that was a very limited application, because that legislation was so bound up in red tape. Both red tape that the Canadian government had put into that legislation to protect pharmaceutical interests, and also because of some of the perceived requirements of the TRIPS agreement, the World Trade Organization. So what we are trying to do currently is ask for a reform of that piece of legislation. We've introduced a bill into Parliament, which is now passed through committee stage and will be heard once more by the House of Commons at the end of January, so coming up very soon. And what they're going to be doing, the final or the third reading of that bill, to see whether it passes into law or not. And the goal of that is to create a very simplified system with a one-license solution, which would get over the vast majority of the problems that we had as we tried to make this order between 2004 and 2010. And so if people are listening to this, we could really do with your support and to get the Parliament to vote in favor of this piece of legislation. So do go onto our website and have a look and act, send a letter to your MP and ask them to vote in favor.
Okay, we'll link to both AIDS Law and to the UAM website from our blog. Before I let you go, can you tell me about some of UAM's successes thus far?
I think the main success we've had, well, we've had main sort of political success, if you like, was this statement of principles and strategies on the licensing of medical technologies, which was issued by a group of six U.S. universities at the end of 2009. So included Yale and Harvard and Pennsylvania and Boston University and a couple of others. And that was a really, it set a new benchmark for the minimum that universities should be doing in order to make sure that their medical technologies are licensed with fair terms for developing countries. And Harvard is taking a real lead in looking into the application of that and applying it to its own technologies as we speak. And that statement has now been signed by around 27 different institutions, including the University of British Columbia. And we're really hoping that universities like Toronto, like your university, like McGill, are going to join with UBC in signing on to that statement, or even signing on to something more strong, making their own global access licensing even stronger than that. We see that as a minimum benchmark, but the fact that that came into play was very much due to the role of students in all the different campuses throughout North America, working really hard with their administrations and creating such a change in the discourse that it became sort of inevitable that this would happen. And that's a real credit to UAM that happened.
Mm-hmm.
I think on another one of the great successes that I would highlight is moving out beyond North America. The idea of how universities are key to ensuring access to essential medicines is really spreading out. Europe now is really adopting the approach that was used first here in the US and Canada. And universities are really starting to come on board. The University of Edinburgh signed its own global access licensing strategy a couple of years ago, and we're hoping that other universities are going to start falling, whether in Germany, in Norway, in Sweden, where we have other chapters of UAM. And on top of that, it's also going out to places like Brazil. We're opening our first chapter of UAM in Brazil very soon. And there that we had a big conference in August 2010 with three or four universities from around Brazil and students from all different campuses. And the fact that, the issues of UAME really have a very big resonance in Brazil and adapting it to their own specific circumstances really shows that there's something very important in there. So I think giving out that message, the communication, the empowerment of other students in other countries to take control of this issue and advocate in their own universities has been a really powerful element of UN's work.
So you mentioned that it was passed or adopted at UBC. Has there been any action on at UBC? Have any technologies actually used that process?
Not that I know of. No, it was fairly recent. I think they signed just I don't know the exact date, but it was within the past year. And as yet, we're monitoring carefully at UBC, but we haven't seen them apply this to anything in specific. And I think, you know, UBC has always been sort of a front runner in applying. It has its own global access strategy, and it has signed on to this statement of principles. But they've been kind of, it's been difficult to see what they've actually been doing differently as a result. And this is part of this process that we think that the statement of principles and strategies still needs to work on is transparency. While it's great for universities to adopt these standards, they have to be transparent about the ways that they're applying them and make that open to public scrutiny so the public can see what their universities are doing and how they're making sure, you know, both that their technologies are available to people in developing countries at low cost or no cost, and secondly, that they're focusing their research and development on the issues that affect the vast majority of the world's population. And that transparency issue is something that UAME is going to be working very hard on over the next few years.
Well, thanks so much for being with us, Rachel.
I've really enjoyed it. Good luck with everything.
Thanks.
Thanks. Bye.
So UAEM chapter has just begun here at McMaster, so we'll link to that organization from our website. Again, it's healthjusticeradio.wordpress.com. And here's Kanon.